Brother Eric John Phelps, welcome to the broadcast of 24/7 World Radio Podcast on this December the 2nd, 2024. I am making this broadcast in three separate parts, and the title of it is The Grand Inquisitor by Fyodor Dostoevsky. This is a classic work that everyone, all my listeners, should be aware of. It was written in 1879 by a Russian author, Fyodor Dostoevsky, and the book is titled The Grand Inquisitor, and it's in several different parts. There's pro and contra, the rebellion, the Grand Inquisitor, and then one last section. But I'm going to read to you chapter 5. It's not chapter 4, the rebellion, it's chapter 5, titled The Grand Inquisitor. And it is a story of two brothers. The older brother, his name is Ivan, and the younger brother, who is a priest, his name is Alyosha, A-L-Y-O-S-H-A. And so we shall start reading on page 17 of my edition of The Grand Inquisitor that was published in 1993 by Hackett Publishing Company, and Post Office Box 44937, Indianapolis, Indiana. And so Dostoevsky lives from 1821 to 1881. He lived 60 years, and he was a great author and dealt with the issues of the day in Russia. Now remember, at this time, as he is busy writing this in the late 1860s, the Alexander II is the Tsar. He is a truly great Tsar. He does away with serfdom in 1861, frees the serfs. He's getting ready to write a constitution for Russia. He was truly a good czar, and I believe he was a saved man. He read the Bible, and his grandfather, Alexander I, had expelled the Jesuits from Russia in 1820. So we're living at a time in Russia where there are no Jesuits, at least legally. They've all run to Georgia. And they've been expelled by Alexander I with a royal ukase. He later set down the Masonic lodges in 1823, and he later was assassinated. He was poisoned with porridge in 1825. But nonetheless, he did the right thing. And so, as Dostoevsky is writing this work, he's warning his people of the power of the Jesuits. And it is most appropriate because in 1905, and again in 1917, the Jesuits will attempt to overthrow the Tsarist government, which they will succeed in 1917. They will have a terrible civil war that will last till 1922. Where over 5,000 priests and nuns will be killed, Orthodox, heretics, according to the Council of Trent. And then they will establish their government there, their communist government, aided by Jesuit, American Jesuit, Edmund A. Walsh, as he's there to oversee the establishment of it, called the Trust. And Edmund A. Walsh would there also be in the White House with FDR, when FDR would formally recognize USSR in December of 1933, and Walsh will be there. Shows you the power of the Jesuits in running not only District of Columbia at that time with their military government of March 9th, 1933, but also using this military government, emergency war powers military government, to give credence to the establishment of the USSR, 8 months later, in December of 1933. So, this is the backdrop. This is what happens after the writing of The Grand Inquisitor, and this is what is before its writing. So we always have to get into the stream of history before we can really understand anything that's going on. So now I will begin to read to you The Grand Inquisitor by Fyodor Dostoevsky, and I will add my comments as we read. Page 17. Quote, "No, I can't admit it, brother," said Alyosha suddenly, with flashing eyes. Quote, you said just now, is there a being in the whole world who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? But there is such a being, capital B, and he, capital H, can forgive anything, all and for all, because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything. That's Christ. Christ sheds his blood for all mankind. You will behold the Lamb of God who taketh away the sin of the world. John 1:29. You have forgotten him, capital H, and on him is built the edifice, and it is to him they cry aloud, quote, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed, unquote. Quote, Ah, the one without sin in his blood. No, I have not forgotten him. On the contrary, I've been wondering all the time how it was you did not bring him in before. For usually all arguments on your side put him in the foreground. Do you know, Alosha? Don't laugh. I made a poem about a year ago. If you can waste another 10 minutes on me, I'll tell it to you. You wrote a poem? Oh, no, I didn't write it, laughed Ivan. And I've never written two lines of poetry in my life. But I made up this poem in prose, and I remembered it. I was carried away when I made it up. You will be my first reader, that is, listener. Why should an author forgo even one listener? Smiled Ivan. Shall I tell it to you? I am all attention, said Alosha. My poem is called The Grand Inquisitor. It's a ridiculous thing, but I want to tell it to you. Well, it's not ridiculous. It's full of truth, and I'm sure Dostoevsky tried to bring about or make you believe that what he was saying was really not true, but it was true, and it is true today. Because many a truth is said in jest, or many a truth is said in the form of a comedy or a novel. Because remember, all the works of Shakespeare and the words of Hamlet are a brief and abstract chronicle of the times. They all pertained to real individual people. And to further understand that, you must read This Star of England by Dorothy and Carlton Ogborne, 1,000 pages, written in 1952. It is the classic work on who was, a.k.a. William Shakespeare, who was, in fact, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, Lord Great Chamberlain to Queen Elizabeth I. And he read the Geneva Bible and quotes the Geneva Bible throughout his works. So he was a saved man, and he dared to tell the truth. All right, back to the Grand Inquisitor. Chapter 5, The Grand Inquisitor. Even this must have a preface, that is, a literary preface, laughed Ivan, and I am a poor hand at making one. You see, my action takes place in the 16th century, and at that time, as you probably learned at school, it was customary in poetry to bring down heavenly powers on earth. Not to speak of Dante in France, clerks as well as the monks in the monasteries used to give regular performances in which the Madonna, the saints, the angels, Christ, and God himself were brought on the stage. In those days it was done in all simplicity. In Victor Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris, an edifying and gratuitous spectacle was provided for the people in the Hotel de Ville of Paris in the reign of Louis XI in honor of the birth of the dolphin. Now, I'm going to stop here for a minute and tell you that Victor Hugo was the absolute enemy of the Jesuit papacy. He was a patriotic Frenchman, and he was thoroughly refused it, rejected it, and so Victor Hugo, I regard as a good guy, a decent Frenchman, in pitting himself against the power of the Jesuits in France in the 1800s. It was called Le Bon Jugement de la Très Sainte et Gracieuse Vierge Marie, unquote. The Merciful Judgment of the Very Saintly and Gracious Virgin Mary. And she appears herself on the stage and pronounces her bon judgment. Similar plays, chiefly from the Old Testament, were occasionally performed in Moscow too, up to the times of Peter the Great. Peter the Great was a good czar. He was a nationalist. He loved Russia. He expelled the Jesuits in like 1753, and he was poisoned. So Peter the Great is another murdered czar at the hands of the Jesuits. He also is bringing Western civilization into Russia and improving Russia. Can't have that. We got to keep Russia in the Dark Ages. So goodbye, Peter the Great. Going on. But besides plays, there were all sorts of legends and ballads scattered about the world in which the saints and angels and all the powers of heaven took part when required. In our monasteries, the monks busied themselves in translating, copying, and even composing such poems, even under the Tartars. There is, for instance, one such poem, of course, from the Greek, quote, The Wanderings of Our Lady Through Hell, unquote, with descriptions as bold as Dante's. Our Lady visits hell, and the Archangel Michael leads her through the torments. She sees the sinners and their punishment. There she sees, among others, one noteworthy set of sinners in a burning lake. Now, of course, this is the lake of fire. This is not hell. Remember, hell is one place. It's a place of torment in flames, Luke 16. And the dead are resurrected out of hell with a second resurrection. They give them the great white throne judgment, and then they're cast alive into the lake of fire, Revelation 20. So always make your distinctions between hell, also called Gehenna, and the lake of fire, Revelation 20. She sees the sinners and their punishment. There she sees, among others, one noteworthy set of sinners in a burning lake. Some of them sink to the bottom of the lake so that they can't swim out. And, quote, these God forgets, unquote. An expression of extraordinary depth and force. And so Our Lady, shocked and weeping, falls before the throne of God and begs for mercy for all in hell, for all she has seen there and indiscriminately. Her conversation with God is immensely interesting. She beseeches him. She will not desist. And when God points to the hands and feet of her son, nailed to the cross, and asks, quote, How can I forgive his tormentors, unquote. She bids all the saints, all the martyrs, all the angels and archangels to fall down with her and pray for mercy on all without distinction. Remember, this is the Catholic belief that Mary is a mediator, right? It ends by her winning from God a respite of suffering every year from Good Friday till Trinity Day. And the sinners at once raise a cry of thankfulness from hell, chanting, quote, Thou art just, O Lord, in this judgment, unquote. Well, my poem would have been of that kind if it had appeared at that time. He comes on the scene in my poem, but he says nothing. Only appears and passes on. 15 centuries have passed since his promise to come in his glory. 15 centuries since his prophet wrote, Behold, I come quickly. Now that's the prophet John, ending at the book of the Revelation in chapter 22. As he himself predicted on earth. But humanity awaits him with the same faith and with the same love. Oh, with greater faith. For it is 15 centuries since man has ceased to see signs from heaven. And remember, this is taking place, according to Ivan the storyteller, in the 1600s, which would be the 15th century. I think it should be 1500s, but it has 15 centuries. So 15 centuries from AD 32 brings us to, what, 1600s. So we see, no signs from heaven come today to add to what the heart doth say. There was nothing left but faith in what the heart doth say. It is true there were many miracles in those days. There were saints who performed miraculous cures. Some holy people, according to their biographies, were visited by the Queen of Heaven herself. Again, Queen of Heaven is a Catholic term, has nothing to do with the Bible, except in Jeremiah chapter 10, where she's a pagan abomination. But the devil did not slumber, and doubts were already arising among men of the truth of these miracles. And just then there appeared in the north of Germany a terrible new heresy. This is the Reformation of Martin Luther. Okay. A huge star like a torch, quote-unquote, that is, to a church, fell on the sources of the waters, and they became bitter. These heretics began blasphemously denying miracles. Well, these are the Protestant, saved Protestants and Baptists that would be denying the miracles of the papacy. The bleeding statues and the bleeding hands and all that nonsense. But those who remained faithful were all the more ardent in their faith. The tears of humanity rose up to him as before, awaiting his coming. Loved him, hoped for him, yearned to suffer and die for him as before. And so, many ages, mankind had prayed with faith and fervor, O Lord our God, hasten thy coming. Unquote. So many ages called upon him that in his infinite mercy he deigned to come down to his servants. Before that day he had come down, he had visited some holy men, martyrs and hermits, as it is written in their lives. Now this lives is the lives of the saints. It's a blasphemous book. It's a papal book. I do have a copy of it, but he's referring to it merely as lives. Among us, Tutachev, with absolute faith in the truth of his words, bore witness that, quote, bearing the cross in slavish dress, weary and worn, the heavenly king, our mother, Russia, came to bless, and throughout our land went wandering. Now, Russia did embrace the gospel in about the 9th century, about the 900s. And you have ultimately the birth of the Orthodox Church in 1054. But there was a gospel witness in Russia for some time, as the poet says here. By the way, the mention here of this heresy is the Protestant Reformation. The Catholic Counter-Reformation began with Luther's act of protest in 1517. So that note is correct. Going on, page 21. And that certainly was so, I assure you. Quote, and behold, he deigned to appear for a moment to the people. Now this is the author's, this is Ivan's story that he's telling, and he's saying that Christ came down to appear to the people for a moment. To the tortured, suffering people, sunk in iniquity, but loving him like children. My story is laid in Spain, in Seville, in the most terrible time of the Inquisition, when fires were lighted every day to the glory of God, and, quote, in the splendid auto de fe. And the auto de fe is a public ceremony of judging and burning heretics during the Spanish Inquisition. And you can read it all about it in H.C. Lea, his History of the Inquisition. In the splendid auto de fe, the wicked heretics were burnt. Oh, of course, this was not the coming in which he will appear according to his promise at the end of time in all his heavenly glory, and which will be sudden, quote, as lightning flashing from east to west, unquote. And that's correct. Matthew 24 says the very same thing, that the coming of Son of Man will be like the lightning that flashes from the east to the west. So the author is familiar with Matthew. No, he visited his children only for a moment, and there where the flames were crackling around the heretics. In his infinite mercy, he came once more among men in that human shape in which he walked among men for 3 years, 15 centuries ago. That's correct. Christ's ministry was 3.5 years, and he celebrated Passover 3 times, not 4 times. He came down to the hot pavement, quote-unquote, of the southern town in which on the day before almost 100 heretics had ad majorem gloriam Dei, which it should be ad majorem Dei gloriam. It's the Jesuit saying, and he says, for the greater glory of God, Jesuit motto. So he's familiar with the Jesuits. Dostoevsky's very familiar with them. He knows their motto. Been burnt by the cardinal, the grand inquisitor, in a magnificent auto de fe, in the presence of the king, the court, the knights, the cardinals, the most charming ladies of the court, and the whole population of Seville. These things actually happened in Seville, Spain. He came softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him. That might be one of the best passages in the poem. I mean, why they recognized him. The people are irresistibly drawn to him. They surround him. They flock about him, follow him. He moves silently in their midst with a gentle smile of infinite compassion. The sun of love burns in his heart. Light and power shine from his eyes, and their radiance shed on the people stirs their hearts with responsive love. He holds out his hands to them, blesses them, and a healing virtue comes from contact with him, even with his garments. And he's familiar then with the Gospel of Matthew, when the woman says, if I can just touch him, I'll be made whole if I touch his garment. He's familiar with that. Dostoevsky's familiar with it. An old man in the crowd, blind from childhood, cries out, O Lord, heal me, and I shall see thee. Unquote. And, as it were, scales fell from his eyes, and the blind man sees him. The crowd weeps and kisses the earth under his feet. Children throw flowers before him. Sing and cry, Hosanna, it is he, it is he. I'll repeat. It must be he. It can be no one but him. He stops at the steps of the Seville Cathedral, at the moment when the weeping mourners are bringing in a little open white coffin. In it lies a child of 7, the only daughter of a prominent citizen. The dead child lies hidden in flowers. He will raise your child, the crowd shouts to the weeping mother. The priest, coming to meet the coffin, looks perplexed and frowns, but the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet with a wail. If it is thou, raise my child, she cries, holding out her hands to him. The procession halts. The coffin is laid on the steps at his feet. He looks with compassion, and his lips once more softly pronounce, Maiden, arise. And the maiden rises. The little girl sits up in the coffin and looks round, smiling with wide-open, wandering eyes, holding a bunch of white roses they had put in her hand. Now, the author is familiar with Christ healing the dead daughter of that particular man when he puts everyone out and says, Tabitha, arise. And so he's familiar with the New Testament book of Matthew, and I think it's in Luke also. Quote, there are cries, sobs, confusion among the people, and at that moment the cardinal himself, the grand inquisitor, passes by the cathedral. He is an old man, almost 90, tall and erect, with a withered face and sunken eyes, in which there is still a gleam of light. He is not dressed in his gorgeous cardinal's robes, as he was the day before, when he was burning the enemies of the Roman Church. At that moment he is wearing his coarse old monk's cassock. Now the Jesuits wear cassocks. So this is a further identification that this inquisitor, this cardinal in a cassock, is a Jesuit, kind of like Cardinal Jesuit Robert Bellarmine. At a distance behind him comes his gloomy assistant and staves. And slaves and the holy guard. He stops at the sight of the crowd and watches it from a distance. He sees everything. He sees them set, the coffin down at his feet, sees the child rise up, and his face darkens. He knits his thick gray brows, and his eyes gleam with a sinister fire. He holds out his finger and bids the guards take him. And such is his power. So completely are the people cowed into submission and trembling obedience to him, that the crowd immediately makes way for the guards, and in the midst of death-like silence they lay hands on him and lead him away. The crowd instantly bows down to the earth, like one man, before the old inquisitor. He blesses the people in silence and passes on. The guards lead their prisoner on to the close, gloomy, vaulted prison in the ancient palace of the Holy Inquisition and shut him in it. The day passes and is followed by the dark, burning, breathless night of Seville. The air is, quote, fragrant with laurel and lemon, unquote. In the pitch darkness, the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone. The door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway and for a minute or two gazes into his face. At last he goes up slowly and sets the light on the table and speaks. Now this is the Grand Inquisitor, the Jesuit, speaking to the man, him who shows up in Seville to do this healing, and this is Christ in this story. Quote, "Is it thou? Thou?" But receiving no answer, he adds at once, "Don't answer, be silent. What canst thou say indeed? I know too well what thou wouldst say, and thou hast no right to add anything to what thou hast said of old. Why, then, art thou come to hinder us? Why, then, art thou come to hinder us? For thou hast come to hinder us, and thou knowest that. But dost thou know what will be tomorrow? I know not who thou art, and care not to know whether it is thou or only a semblance of him. But tomorrow I shall condemn thee and burn thee at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the people who have today kissed thy feet, tomorrow at the faintest sign from me, will rush to heap up the embers of thy fire. Knowest thou that? Yes, maybe thou knowest it," he added, and with thoughtful penetration, never for a moment taking his eyes off the prisoner, capital P, the prisoner. Quote, "I don't quite understand, Ivan. What does it mean?" Alyosha, who had been listening in silence, said with a smile. "It is simply a wild fantasy or a mistake on the part of the old man, some impossible quid pro quo. I benefit, you benefit." Okay. Quote, "Take it as the last," said Ivan, laughingly. "If you are so corrupted by modern realism and can't stand anything fantastic, if you like it to be a case of mistaken identity, let it be so. It is true." He went on laughing. The old man was 90, and he might well be crazy over his set idea. He might have been struck by the appearance of the prisoner. It might, in fact, be simply his ravings, the delusion of an old man of 90, overexcited by the auto-de-fe, that's the burning of the heretics, of 100 heretics the day before. But does it matter to us, after all, whether it was a mistake of identity or a wild fantasy? All that matters is that the old man should speak out, should speak openly of what he has thought in silence for 90 years. And the prisoner, too, is silent. Does he look at him and not say a word? That's inevitable in any case, Ivan laughed again. The old man has told him he hasn't the right to add anything to what he has said old. One may say it is the most fundamental feature of Roman Catholicism, in my opinion at least. All has been given by thee to the Pope, they say, and all therefore is still in the Pope's hands. And there is no need for thee to come now at all. You see, because papacy considers the Pope to be the vicar of Christ, when, of course, it's the Holy Spirit who's the vicar of Christ, the substitute for Christ while he's not here. Thou must not meddle. For the time, at least, that's how they speak and write to the Jesuits, at any rate. I have read it myself in the works of their theologians. That's right, the Jesuits have, they're called moral theologians. They have moral theology, and it's really some of the most immoral stuff you'll ever read. Dostoevsky's quite familiar with it. Hast thou the right to reveal to us one of the mysteries of that world from which thou hast come? My old man asks him, and answers the question for him. No, thou hast not. That thou mayest not add to what has been said of old, and mayest not take from men the freedom which thou didst exalt when thou wast on earth. Whatsoever thou revealest anew will encroach on men's freedom of faith, for it will be manifest as a miracle, and the freedom of their faith was dearer to thee than anything in those days 1500 years ago. Dost thou not often say, I will make you free? Of course he said it in John 14. If the Son make you free, you shall be free indeed. But now thou hast seen these quote-unquote free men, the old man adds suddenly, with a pensive smile. Yes, we've paid dearly for it, he goes on, looking sternly at him. But at last we have completed that work in thy name. For 15 centuries we've been wrestling with thy freedom, but now it is ended and over for good. You see how the Jesuits want to end political liberty, freedom of conscience, speech, and press? They were laboring at it. Here they are in the Inquisition. Now it's ended and over for good. Dost thou not believe that it's over for good? Thou lookest meekly at me and deignest not even to be wroth with me. But let me tell thee that now, today, people are more persuaded than ever that they have perfect freedom, yet they have brought their freedom to us and laid it humbly at our feet. But that has been our doing. Was this what thou didst? Was this thy freedom? I don't understand again, Alyosha broke in. Is he ironical? Is he jesting? Not a bit of it. He claims it as a merit for himself and his church that at last they have vanquished freedom and have done so to make men happy. For now he is speaking of the Inquisition, of course. For the first time it has become possible to think of the happiness of men. Man was created a rebel, and how can rebels be happy? Thou wast warned, he says to him. Thou hast had no lack of admonitions and warnings, but thou dost not listen to those warnings. Thou dost reject the only way by which men might be made happy. But fortunately, departing, thou dost hand on the work to us. Christ supposedly giving Peter the keys of heaven, and Peter following Christ and being the first pope, that's what he's talking about here. Thou hast given to us the right hand, the right to bind and to unbind, and now, of course, thou canst not think of taking it away. Why then hast thou come to hinder us? And what's the meaning of no lack of admonitions and warnings, asks Alyosha. Why, that's the chief part of what the old man must say. The wise, and here's what the old man says, the wise and dread spirit, the spirit of self-destruction and non-existent, the old man goes on. The great spirit talked with thee in the wilderness, and we are told in the books that he tempted thee. Now, of course, he's speaking of Satan. Is that so? And could anything truer be said than what he revealed to thee in 3 questions? And what thou didst reject? And what in the books is called, quote-unquote, the temptation? And yet, if there has ever been on earth a real stupendous miracle, it took place on that day, on the day of the 3 temptations. The statement of those 3 questions was itself the miracle. If it were possible to imagine, simply for the sake of argument, that those 3 questions of the dread spirit had perished utterly from the books, and that we had to restore them and to invent them anew, and to do so had gathered together all the wise men of the earth, rulers, chief priests, learned men, philosophers, poets, and had set them the task to invent 3 questions such as would not only fit the occasion, but express in 3 words, 3 human phrases, the whole future history of the world and of humanity. Dost thou believe that all the wisdom of the earth united could have invented anything in depth and force equal to the 3 questions which were actually put to thee then by the wise and mighty spirit, namely Satan, in the wilderness? From those questions alone, from the miracle of their statement, we can see that we have here to do not with the fleeting human intelligence, but with the absolute and eternal. For in those 3 questions, the whole subsequent history of mankind is, as it were, brought together into one whole and foretold, and in them are united all the unsolved historical contradictions of human nature. At the time, it could not be so clear, since the future was unknown. But now that 1,500 years have passed, we see that everything in those 3 questions was so justly divined and foretold, and has been so truly fulfilled, that nothing can be added to them or taken from them. Judge thyself who was right, thou or he who questioned thee, then. So the Inquisitor's saying, hey, you judge who's right, you or the Satan. Remember, the first question, its meaning could be put this way. Thou wouldst go into the world and art going with empty hands, with some promise of freedom which men in their simplicity and their natural unruliness cannot even understand, which they fear and dread, for nothing has ever been more insupportable for a man and a human society than freedom. But seest thou these stones in this parched and barren wilderness? Turn them into bread, and mankind will run after thee like a flock of sheep, grateful and obedient, though forever trembling, lest thou withdraw thy hand and deny them thy bread. But thou wouldst not deprive man of freedom, and just reject the offer, thinking what is that freedom worth if obedience is bought with bread? Thou dost reply that man lives not by bread alone, but thou dost know that for the sake of that earthly bread, the spirit of the earth will rise up against thee and will strive with thee and overcome thee and all who follow him, crying, who can compare with this beast? Now, this is the beast of Revelation 13. This is the beast, the man beast of Revelation 13, verse 4. Who is like unto the beast? Who can make war with the beast? He has given us fire from heaven. That's the false prophet, Revelation 13. Dost thou know that the ages will pass and humanity will proclaim by the lips of their sages that there is no crime and therefore no sin, there is only hunger? Feed men and then ask of them virtue. That's what they'll write on the banner which they will raise against thee and with which they will destroy thy temple. Now the temple will be destroyed. The third Hebrew temple will be destroyed in Revelation 11. And we know the second temple was destroyed. But also he may be referring to the temple of the body of Christ. It will destroy thy temple. Where thy temple stood will rise a new building. The terrible Tower of Babel will be built again. And though, like the one of old, it will not be finished, yet thou mightest have prevented that new tower and have cut short the sufferings of men for 1,000 years. For they will come back to us after 1,000 years of agony with their tower. Now remember, Babylon will be rebuilt according to Revelation 18 and Jeremiah 50:51. Dostoevsky may have known this. They will seek us again, hidden underground in the catacombs, for we shall be again persecuted and tortured. They will find us and cry to us, feed us, for those who have promised us fire from heaven haven't given it. And then we shall finish building their tower, for he finishes the building who feeds them. And we alone shall feed them in thy name, declaring falsely that it is in thy name. Oh, never, never can they feed themselves without us. No science will give them bread so long as they remain free. In the end, they will lay their freedom at our feet and say to us, make us your slaves, but feed us. They will understand themselves at last that freedom and bread enough for all are inconceivable together, for never, never will they be able to share between them. They will be convinced, too, that they can never be free, for they are weak, vicious, worthless, and rebellious. Thou dost promise them the bread of heaven, but, I repeat again, can it compare with earthly bread in the eyes of the weak, ever sinful, and ignoble race of man? And if for the sake of the bread of heaven thousands and tens of thousands shall follow thee, what is to become of the millions and tens of millions, tens of thousands of millions of creatures who will not have the strength to forego the earthly bread for the sake of the heavenly? Or dost thou care only for the tens of thousands of the great and strong, while the millions, numerous as the sands of the sea, who are weak but love thee, must exist only for the sake of the great and strong? No, we care for the weak too. They are sinful and rebellious, but in the end they too will become obedient. They will marvel at us and look at us as gods because we are ready to endure the freedom which they have found so dreadful and to rule over them so awful it will seem to them to be free. But we shall tell them that we are thy servants and rule them in thy name. we shall deceive them again, for we will not let thee come to us again. That deception will be our suffering, for we shall be forced to lie. This is the significance of the first question in the wilderness, and this is what thou hast rejected for the sake of that freedom which thou hast exalted above everything. Yet in this question lies hidden the great secret of the world. Choosing bread, quote unquote, thou wouldst have satisfied the universal and everlasting craving of humanity to find someone to worship. So long as man remains free, he strives for nothing so incessantly and so painfully as to find something to worship. But man seeks to worship what is established beyond dispute, so that all men would agree at once to worship it. For these pitiful creatures are concerned not only to find what one or the other can worship, but to find something that all would believe in and worship. What is essential is that all may be together in it. This craving for community, in italics, of worship, is the chief mystery of every man individually and of all humanity from the beginning of time. For the sake of common worship, they have slain each other with a sword. They have set up gods and challenged one another. Put away your gods and come and worship ours, or we will kill you and your gods. Unquote. And so it will be to the end of the world. Even when gods disappear from the earth, they will fall down before idols just the same. Thou didst know, thou couldst not but have known, this fundamental secret of human nature. But thou didst reject the one infallible banner that was offered thee to make all men bow down to thee alone, the banner of earthly bread. And thou hast rejected it for the sake of freedom and the bread of heaven. Behold what thou didst further. And all again in the name of freedom? I tell thee that man is tormented by no greater anxiety than to find someone quickly to whom he can hand over that gift of freedom with which the ill-fated creature is born. But only one who can appease their conscience can take over their freedom. In bread there was offered thee, in bread there was offered thee an invincible banner. Give bread, and the man will worship thee, for nothing is more certain than bread. But if someone else gains possession of his conscience, oh, then he will cast away thy bread and follow after him who has ensnared his conscience. In that thou wast right, for the secret of man's being is not only to live, but to have something to live for. Without a stable conception of the object of life, man would not consent to go on living, and would rather destroy himself than remain on earth, though he had bread in abundance. That is true. But what happened? Instead of taking men's freedom from them, thou dost make it greater than ever. Dost thou forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom of choice and the knowledge of good and evil? Nothing is more seductive for man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing is a greater cause of suffering. And behold, instead of giving a firm foundation for setting the conscience of man at rest forever, thou dost choose all that is exceptional, vague, and enigmatic. That means a mystery-like. An enigma is a mystery. Enigmatic. Thou dost choose what was utterly beyond the strength of men, acting as though thou didst not love them at all. Thou who didst come to give life, thy life for them. Instead of taking possession of men's freedom, thou dost increase it and burden the spiritual kingdom of mankind with its sufferings forever. Thou dost desire man's free love, that he should follow thee freely, enticed and taken captive by thee. In place of the rigid ancient law, man must hereafter, with free heart, decide for himself what is good and what is evil, having only thy image before him as his guide. But didst thou not know he would at least reject even thy image and thy truth, if he is weighed down with the fearful burden of free choice? They will cry aloud at last that the truth is not in thee, for they could not have been left in greater confusion and suffering than thou hast caused, laying upon them so many cares and unanswerable problems. We shall stop there in our reading. This is the first section of The Grand Inquisitor by Dostoevsky. And he has read the scriptures, and he obviously has an understanding of the Inquisition and the Jesuits and, of course, Satan. So we'll be back with our second recording of The Grand Inquisitor shortly. This is December 2nd, 2024.